If I can ask Esther and Ifti to come, we move into the next section, which is the release of the new shelter and disaster risk reduction scoping study.
Good morning. I'm Esther Charlesworth, and I'm an Associate Professor in Architecture at RMIT and Founding Director of Architects Without Frontiers in Australia. And I'll be briefly introducing a project that we've been undertaking over the last year. This project is called Shelter and Disaster Risk Reduction in the Asia Pacific Region. The project really came about through a discussion in the Australian Shelter Reference Group over the last 18 months. And it was effectively coordinated by James Shell from Habitat for Humanity and funded through Caritas and AusAid, and Richard Forsyth through Caritas was the major person there. So thanks to them. The project that IFTI will be presenting today, because he's done the bulk of the work, is very much a pilot study which produced a draft evaluation tool for assessing disaster resilience in shelter projects across the Asia Pacific region. IFTI will be talking about the two case study countries that we looked at, Cook Islands and Sri Lanka, because effectively the tool was done, the field work and the analysis and the write-up in 4 months. So it was done very, very quickly. The project was undertaken through the auspices of HARB, or the newly established Humanitarian Architecture Research Bureau at RMIT, which has been established within the School of Architecture to develop research and projects in the humanitarian sector. Getting back to the tool, the aim of the tool was ultimately to provide an evaluation matrix, a practical evaluation matrix for use by local agency staff undertaking future shelter projects, because we found that there were very few simple and practical monitoring and evaluation tools that have been done after disasters over the last decade. I'll now hand over to Ifti Ahmed, who again did most of the work in the field and pulling the project together, but just again to acknowledge the support of AusAid, Caritas and Habitat for Humanity, and James in coordinating the project and for the opportunity to present it today. Outside there is a copy of the final report of the tool, and just to say, stress again that it is a pilot project. We hope that it can be used and refined in future case studies. But this was done in a very short time period, so I'll hand over to Ifti. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. Good morning. I will launch into it, and look, this is a 100-page report, and you will have access to it because there are multiple copies outside. So I won't go into the details of it. I just want to give you a little snapshot of the whole project. And essentially, it all started from like issues such as these, which the Shelter Reference Group kept on encountering over there, you know, working in the developing world, that the developing world, developing countries are increasingly getting more and more affected by disasters, and something has to be done about it in terms of looking at shelter that can withstand, you know, future impacts. So this is the basic premise on how this project was commissioned. But also, there's a lot of rhetoric on building back better. And we wanted to look at, you know, how much of this rhetoric is actually true in practice. So that's what spurred us on to work on this project. So one of the key deliverables in this project was a literature review, looking at what has been done in this field of, look, we had a very narrow lens to look at this. This was mainly about disaster risk reduction and shelter. That's about it. But trying to do that was obviously challenging because there's the gamut of issues surrounding shelter, as Graham Tretton now outlined, that shelter is not only about building a house, but it relates to a whole range of issues. So, but we looked at essentially two main aspects, disaster reduction shelter and evaluation frameworks, but specifically relating to shelter and disaster reduction. And we found very few we found very few toolkits or evaluation techniques that looked specifically at this narrow, you know, objective. So this is what, and we found that it was important to actually develop an evaluation tool, which was the second deliverable of this particular project. And to do that, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. There are millions of evaluation toolkits, but what we really need to do is to adapt things from them and then custom make a toolkit which is specifically tailored towards assessing disaster risk reduction in shelter. So yeah, that's what I said, and this is one of the toolkits, and I'll actually come to one example, a framework which kind of really informed us later. But these are, you know, this is just a flavor of kind of things that we looked at. And this is a snapshot of the evaluation tool. Sorry, it probably doesn't do justice to the complexity of the toolkit, but I try to summarize it in a very short way so that it's understandable, the three main stages. And the central stage, the assessment stage, is the heart of the toolkit. And within the assessment stage, what we found, at least in our little pilot study, it could be different when other people apply it, but, you know, each... within each stage, there are a set of guided activities, as you can see on the right-hand side, and the key informant interviews were central, as we found out, in informing our assessment. So we tested them in two different countries, one in the Pacific, the Cook Islands, and one in Asia, Sri Lanka. And both had experienced major disasters. There was a big cyclone in 2010 in the Cook Islands, and the tsunami, 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, is well known in Sri Lanka. So again, just a little snapshot of some of the key features in these case studies. And, you know, I can't go into the details of it, but we went through extensive consultation with various members of the shelter reference groups and in looking at which projects should we look at, which projects do you have which have attempted to implement resilience features in shelter. And so we finally, you know, came up with these projects. And all of them had built-in DRR measures. If they didn't, there would be no sense in looking at them in a pilot study. So that was a criterion to look at them. And look, I promised you about this slide, and I'll show it. I'm sorry, it's a complex slide, and I don't want to go through it. But this is sort of the analytical framework which informed the development of the toolkit, especially the key informant interviews, which I mentioned was central. And then finally, to analyze the findings of the interviews. So essentially, there are five main elements. And again, I can't go into great details. If you're really interested, the report is out there. And I will also be available throughout the day to talk more about it. So just giving you again a snapshot of the case studies that was in the Cook Islands, and we found that the houses built under this program, they were very well built, very sturdy, surely able to withstand future disaster impacts of a very high magnitude, but there were other issues. And again, like I mentioned, that when we started working with this narrow lens with the blinkers, we saw that there were many things outside the perspective which were influencing, you know, the work. For example, in this particular context, people had very large families, and very small houses did not fit their needs. Even though they were sturdy enough, many of them had to build extensions. Now, would these extensions be resistant to future disaster impacts? We don't know. So there you go, a little anecdote from one of the beneficiaries, and he says, the house is over-designed. That's really strong, well-designed for the purpose, but it's good, I think. They have done what they wanted to do. They wanted to build disaster-resistant housing, and they did it. This is another one. It's a very smaller project. It's less ambitious in scale, and what it really does is it's very targeted. It wanted to fix up the roofing because that is what flies off if there's a storm, and they have a very simple system of anchoring down the roof. And again, you know, it's much stronger, much better than what they have there, and they will withstand future cyclone impacts. But again, external factors. Cost of imported materials. The Cook Islands, as you may know, imports almost everything from mostly New Zealand and other places. So there's a slap-on added cost every time you bring in something from outside. And you're not also reliable about the supply, you know, whether it's going to come on time. So issues such as these often surround, you know, very well-intentioned DRR measures. Again, another anecdote, and she says, you know, it's better than nothing. And obviously it's better than nothing. And then going to Sri Lanka, again, looking at this project. And this project was actually a very challenging project because this, and some of you may know, that in Sri Lanka there was extensive relocation of people away from the coast to reduce their future risk. But in this particular project, it was an in-situ project because the tsunami had traveled inland through rivers and creeks and really inundated and destroyed this whole place. But they decided to build in that place, but they raised the land above flooding. There are still challenges. The houses very near to the river still get flooded to some extent. But to actually make it absolute disaster-proof would mean raising the land by 10 meters, which is ridiculous. But they raised it by 2 meters, which is still very good. So there's always a little balance, a little bit of compromise, but it's still better than how they lived before. And if you see in that photograph, the house on the left-hand side is what they had before, and the house there, which you can't really see too well, is what they got. So it's definitely a giant leap in terms of the context, you know, in what they lived in. But again, external factors. They had to rely on the government to provide drainage and roads and et cetera, which one wasn't forthcoming. It took a long time, and there were all kinds of problems. So, yeah. Again, you know, when you talk to people, they all testify that this has really improved their living conditions. They are much more resilient than they were before. Another example, again, from Sri Lanka, similar, over time, consolidating, you know, community resilience, yeah? And yeah, similar. And again, anecdotes from, or narratives from the beneficiaries just say that, yes, you know, this is just much better than we could ever afford or ever had before. And this is another one, the last one, which we looked at, World Vision. And again, very similar. They moved people inside. It was a relocation project, but not that far. It was roughly in the range of a kilometer away from the coast. So they could still pursue their traditional livelihoods without having to, you know, do something else. And it's an integrated development approach. They also built in a DRR training component. So as you can see in that photograph, there's a tsunami warning tower, but people were trained how to react to early warning of tsunamis, for example. But again, same problem. External factors, the government didn't match the efforts of organizations such as World Vision to improvement and resilience building. Same, some more narratives, so was it so strong, you cannot even drive an aid through them, for example. Or even if you talk to one of the agency staff, say that, look, you know, we just don't do just housing. We try to deliver them a whole package within our means. Some of the things, we wanted to build roads, but the government won't let us build roads because it's their duty. But then they won't do it. So how can we hold them accountable? Right, so very quickly, you know, just to go through, you know, all the projects, as I said, they were disaster resilient, and we used the toolkit to find that they were, but there were other factors which I mentioned, partly meeting user needs in terms of, like I said, family size, etc., external factors, etc. But we also, while we were doing this study, we looked at some of the projects and we found, for example, that it's important to have an integrated approach, but also for agencies to have a long-term engagement with the community. It can take time, it can take more resources, but over the long run, they can produce desirable results. But we also looked at ourselves, we evaluated the evaluation toolkit, and we found that, yes, it needs a lot of skill and experience, and hence it would need training, and some of the activities may need to be custom-made according to the context. For example, we didn't do the hazard mapping and ranking because in these particular contexts, they weren't relevant. And finally, what we really wanted to suggest is that agencies who do shelter should have this as an inbuilt procedure, a standard procedure within their organization. And they should also look at the toolkit as something flexible that they can adapt to looking at shelter in other circumstances, not only DRR, but they can adapt it to their own needs. Yeah, that's about it. Thank you.